It is a beautiful day to be alive, and I'm so glad we have this time together. I'm Sunna Laybourne, she, her. I am a professor, scholar, connector, and avid reader. I've always loved learning about what's happening in our social world and sharing that knowledge, especially over a good cup of coffee. And so here we are. Each week on Let's Grab Coffee, I catch up with experts from around the world who are investigating our most pressing social issues and common curiosities. And today, I have a very special conversation to share with you. Each year, hundreds of thousands of people from around the world descend upon Austin, Texas for the annual South by Southwest Festival and Conference. This brings together creatives from a variety of fields spanning media, music, television, culture, technology, all to talk about what's new in their fields. I had the absolute honor of moderating a panel discussion featuring some folks you might know, including former guests of the show, Dominic Lawson, Letta McCullough-Seletsky, and Chastity Jade. This morning, I am sharing that conversation with you. The panel was telling it like it is, was, and could be. Let's tune in.
I am so excited that you all are here and are awake and having a good morning here in Austin at South By. We are so excited to bring you this panel this morning, telling it like it is, was, and could be. My name is Sunna Laybourne, and I'm going to serve as your moderator in this amazing conversation with three creatives spanning different media fields. So let's go ahead and introduce these lovely folks on stage. Right here to my immediate right is Chastity Jade. Chastity is an established film editor and indie director with over 10 years experience. She graduated top of her class from Miami International University of Art and Design. Chastity made her directorial debut with a self-written short film, Brown Ballerina, which was selected to Toronto Shorts. In 2020, she made history as the first minority senior editor for the NBA during the 2020 bubble. She recently worked under Parallax Post LA on something you may have heard of, Beyoncé's Lemonade, and Oscar-nominated film Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Chastity currently owns her own film editing company, Edit Bay Post, and is the post advisor for the Black Girls Film Camp. Her credits include Beats by Dre, Nike, Savage Fenty, BET, the Super Bowl, and more. Her nonprofit, Crown Me Royal Labs, curates art shows for emerging mixed-media female artists. With Southern and Caribbean roots, Chastity is an advocate for expanding creative media education for minority professionals in the Southern region and curating opportunities for female artists. Welcome, Chastity.
Thank you. Like, is that me?
That is you, yes. Next to her is Dominic Lawson, a 22-time award-winning podcast producer, host, and editor. Since 2016, Dominic has been the creator and host of the Startup Life podcast, bringing listeners the edge they need in building their businesses and climbing the corporate ladder. He's had the pleasure of interviewing Mark Randolph, co-founder and first CEO of Netflix, Tom Golisano, founder and chairman of Paychex, and many others. The Startup Life has over 300 episodes and is syndicated nationally and internationally. Dominic joined the Meadows Behavioral Healthcare family in 2021 as a podcast producer, editor, and host, where he's responsible for cultivating a diverse slate of guests ranging from mental health experts to addiction recovery professionals. He also hosts the long-running series Beyond Theory podcast that brings you in-depth conversations with firsthand insights from the people on the front lines of mental health and addiction recovery. In 2022, Meadows Behavioral Healthcare launched the Recovery Replay podcast, journaling personal stories of recovery. Also in 2022, Dominic launched the Black is America podcast, highlighting little-known African-American figures and other stories. Black is America is already an award-winning podcast, and his episode on Tom Lee beat out ESPN and other major media at the Webbies. Black is America is in its third season. Welcome, Dominic.
Thank you for having me.
And rounding out this stellar panel is Lita McCullough-Seletsky. Lita is a National Endowment for the Arts 2022 Creative Writing Fellow. She is the author of The Kneeling Man, My Father's Life as a Black Spy Who Witnessed the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., which is a Library Journal Best Book of 2023 and BookPage Best Nonfiction Book of 2023. Lita is a litigator turned essayist and memoirist. Her works appear in The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Griot, the Oprah Magazine, The Washington Post, and elsewhere. She holds a BA from Northwestern University and a JD from the George Washington University Law School. Welcome, Lita.
Thank you.
So let's jump right into this conversation this morning. Now, each of you, you're spanning different media fields. So we have podcasting, we have film, we have essays, and each of you are also telling stories that deepen but often really challenge some of our popular understandings of the world that we live in. And each of your work has been enthusiastically well received. I'm wondering, what led you to tell these particular stories and why now?
Oh, I guess I'll jump in. I think it's been time for a lot of stories to be told, and now we're just in an age where obviously there's social media, there's awareness, there's diversity campaigns, so a lot of it is just being more accepted and not even just accepted, but seen. You know, you kind of had these gatekeepers that were kind of, you know, just kind of protecting everything, and they were only letting certain people in the door, and now people are just kicking down the door. So I feel like it's been time, but now just with how the world is changing, the doors are opening up. And for me personally, every story or any project that I take into consideration has always been something that's personal to me. And sometimes a lot of people think my resume is all over the place. Like, what is this? You're doing Asian films, you're doing this, you're doing that. But I'm like, well, I'm a military brat, and I'm Caribbean, and Afro-Latino. Like, I'm a lot of different things. And my father was stationed in Korea for, like, probably 15 years. So it made sense for me to do something like Everything Everywhere All at Once. And I was really into fashion. And my mom is kind of like a hippie. So working with Savage Fenty, like, that makes sense to me. So a lot of things are kind of deeply rooted into who I am and how I grew up and the stories that I want to tell. Growing up with a sister who's a ballerina. So I did Brown Ballerina. Like, it's crazy, but it makes sense. And I think it's just important for us to kind of dig deep and, instead of us being so focused on what's accepted, like, really focusing on what our personal story is, almost like a journal entry, and it's up to, you know, the world to, you know, accept it or understand or not, but that shouldn't be the focal point. It should just come from within.
Mm-hmm. You want me to go or you go?
You go.
Okay. I was trying to be a gentleman, so I was just making sure.
You are, yes.
Oh, okay. So for me, everything Chastity said, but also for me, if I'm being honest, a little bit of a stroke of pettiness, because I remember my wife coming across an article from a Hollywood producer saying that every story that's been told, every story that needed to be told, needs to be told, has already been told. And as a person of color, I was like, nope, that's not true. Right? No, because, you know, and then I'll see something, you know, especially during Black History Month or any time during the year, about a story about John Fox, this African-American soldier who called military fire on himself. I'm like, I never heard that story growing up in school or even in our backyard when you mentioned Tom Lee, right? You know, like, we've heard of Tom Lee Park in Memphis, but never knew the true story. For the longest time, I thought Tom Lee was a white man, right? And so clearly it just goes to show that, you know, these stories have to be told. They have to be told in a unique way so that way people can gravitate towards them. And also so, you know, people who look like me or people who look like whatever can feel affirmed in these stories. So that's kind of was the jumping point for me.
Yes, and just picking up on what you said about these stories that have gone untold and really it's a form of erasure devaluation. This was certainly the case with the story behind my book, The Kneeling Man, My Father's Life as a Black Spy Who Witnessed the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And so in my case, I was thinking about issues of legacy and kind of like Chastity said, you know, this sense that this is the time now to uncover these stories and see where they take us. And so with my father, you know, I did not know what I would tell my children, my boys, about their grandfather, who was, he found himself at a very tragic and pivotal moment in American history, and yet next to nothing was known about why he was there and what he was doing there. And so what filled in that vacuum of information was really largely conspiracy theories. And so I just reached the point where I said, you know, we've got to break this silence and we've got to tell that story because this is something that's not only of personal import, but it is a missing puzzle piece of American history and world history.
Yeah, Lita, I want to start off kind of where you left off in thinking about what is the intentional decision-making? And this is a question for all of you, but Lita, I'll start with you. Intentional decision-making about how you tell the stories, maybe what's included, what's excluded, and thinking about the overall narrative that you want to share.
Right. So two real crucial decision points. And I mean, the first one really was to actually stop running away from the story, which I had done for most of my life, and actually run to the story and embrace the story and try to unpack it. Because, you know, again, growing up, only knowing that, you know, my father was in this famous photograph taken in the moments after Dr. King's assassination, you know, and knowing that my father was a Memphis police officer, that's all my family ever said about it. But then finding out from the newspaper that, well, actually, he was a little more than just any old regular police officer. He was an undercover police officer who was infiltrating a black activist group in Memphis, and it was doing that work that happened to bring him to the Lorraine Motel on that day. And he really just, you know, when Dr. King was shot, he went into first responder mode and ran up a staircase to assist Dr. King. So, but I didn't know the context beyond what was in the paper, that he was just this police mole. Now, you know, at the same time, I also knew that after that event happened, you know, so Dr. King's assassination was in 1968. Well, in 1974, he was recruited to the Central Intelligence Agency. So I knew that he was a CIA officer. So putting all this together without context looked extremely sinister to me and to a lot of people. And so I just thought, you know, the best outcome of all of this would be if no one ever connects me to this story. But then, you know, of course, as I mentioned earlier, I came to the point where, you know, I decided that, you know, you cannot run from things like that. You know, and every family has these sort of taboo subjects, but it's sort of like, you know, I thought I could move on, but we don't move on. You know, to paraphrase a great writer, what he said, I think it was J.S. Park, we don't move on, we move with. So all the time I was moving with this story, but not really knowing the particulars. So the first decision point was to tell the story in the first place. The second decision point in the narrative was to interweave my own you know, narrative with my father's. So in the book, you know, it is a braided narrative. So some of the chapters are about his experience and some of them are from my perspective. And I decided that was important because his story really was interwoven with mine and the ripple effects of the decisions that he made, the things that he was swept into, had definite impacts on my life. And so that was another decision that I had to make narratively as well.
I think the first decision I have to make, you know, is at the end of an episode for Black is America, how do I want my audience to feel, right? And so I have to go kind of figure out what that is and then backwards plan from there. Because I know in many mediums and film, TV and stuff like that, the person of color, not just black people, but the person of color is the sidekick. Right. It's the you know, the person on off to the side is kind of like, you know, not necessarily super intelligent, but like helpful in some kind of way. So I knew in the story of Tom Lee, like, no, he's the hero. He's the hero. Or in the story of John Fox, he's the hero. And so along the narrative arc, I'm getting you, kind of like to your point, I'm getting you invested in the hero. So you're not just going to learn about the action. You're going to learn about his family, his daughter. You're going to learn about some goofy stuff he did as a kid. You know, right? Like you're really going to be related to this character. So by the time you're at the end of this narrative arc, he makes that ultimate sacrifice, called a military strike on himself, you're going to feel something, right? And so that's kind of some of those decisions I make.
I love that. I think for me, as a film editor, who is, my decisions are kind of based on a lot of other people's decisions, you absolutely have to be a critical thinker, and you have to rest in who you are personally and culturally. So I find myself kind of combating people who aren't necessarily a part of certain cultures or of certain dialects or certain things. So really short story. I was working on a campaign. This was during COVID. It was talking about voting. And they had a scene where it was a group of women talking about, like, oh, I'm not going to vote. Like, this is crazy. And how it was positioned was, you know, there's a black woman on top of the stairs, and there was a group of white women on the bottom of the stairs. And the black woman was like, yeah, I'm not going. And then one of the other girls downstairs was like, yeah, I'm not going either. And then the other two girls were like, we have to go, we have to go. And me just thinking about this company and all the trouble they've been in, I was like, we cannot have a group of women who could not vote or have rights for years, now saying, you know what, I'm not gonna go vote, and then have the black woman be the leader of the conversation and have her friends be the ones encouraging her. This is not gonna fly well. So it's just certain things like that that you kind of have to, like, stand up and think about and really be intentional, not necessarily like having a campaign where it's like, I'm gonna protest and I'm never editing again. Like, it's not that serious. But you do have to, like, really be intentional about operating in that space, because it can have a triple effect to a lot of different things that we continuously experience. And there's always conversations of, like, how did this get past producers? How did they get this past all these people? But if we're in those rooms, regardless of where you come from, like, if there's a certain way that you speak Italian or a certain way that you, you know, do something in the islands, like, it's important to really stress that dialogue and have that attention to detail.
I love that you brought that up, Chastity, because it made me think about, you know, some of the challenges that I'm sure you all have faced in thinking about the stories that you want to tell, and how, Dominic, even how you mentioned about how you want your audience to feel, right? Because these stories are doing something to us and in us and through us. And so I'm wondering if you could speak to any challenges you faced in creating the stories that you've wanted to tell. And maybe those are even internal challenges. Lita, you kind of touched on that a little bit, but even external challenges. Right? Like, you're working with another company and you're maybe thinking about the power dynamics or even, you know, your livelihood. So maybe some of the challenges in telling the stories that you want to tell in the way that you hope to be able to tell them. And again, internal or external challenges.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I think my biggest challenge is always fighting culture, which I kind of talked about in the last question. I remember I was working at the time it was Viacom, and Viacom owned MTV, BET, VH1, all those things. And all the producers were older. I'm the youngest in the room, and they would always give me this list of names because they didn't know who the artists were. So I'm literally writing, like, oh, this is Miley Cyrus, this is T.I., this is Gucci Mane, like, this is, you know, and I'm just like, how are y'all in these positions? You know, you can kind of feel that way. So for me personally, like, I feel like I'm always fighting culture, but I also know that eventually I'm going to get older, and just being able to work with the Black Girls Film Camp and having an intern that I have here today, being able to stay hip to, like, okay, what's going on with TikTok? Because I don't know what you're talking about. So I think, like, culturally is always a fight for me, but also, again, being the voice in the room and also exposing myself to other cultures and things that I want to learn, whether it's old or whether it's new.
So I'll go in a different direction from Black is America and speak to my day job at the Meadows, but Recovery Replay in particular. So Recovery Replay is a show that I created that talks about a person's journey of recovery, but from three different perspectives. So it's like the person in recovery, a loved one, and then like a clinician, and all these stories are kind of weaved into one comprehensive narrative. And so I remember pitching it to, you know, my superiors and stuff like that. And there's like, well, you know, we hear stories of recovery and journey and stuff like that. But I'm like, no, I think this is different. I think we can tell it in a raw and real way. Because while when you see videos of people like in recovery and stuff like that, you see them having a picnic or they're on the beach and stuff like that. But if I just passed out drunk the night before, or I'm going through a substance abuse situation, I can't relate to that. At least not yet. But I can't relate to that right now. And so one of the things we know about addiction is that isolation fuels it. And so with Recovery Replay, what we want to do is to kind of break through that isolation through podcasting, right? And so, no, so just trying to get that, to sell that part of that show, you know, was a bit challenging. After that is one of the rules I have with Recovery Replay is, let's say there's the person in recovery and a spouse. One of the rules I have is you can't be in the same room. Like, the other person has to leave when I'm interviewing the other person because I don't want couched answers, right? I want, again, I'm trying to have this very real, authentic conversation so that way the person who's going to listen to this is going to feel like, okay, I feel that. You know what? I thought I was the only one going through this. I can relate to that, right? And so that's another difficulty. But from that difficulty, we have these answers and these conversations that even the spouses didn't know they were feeling, right? The first episode of Recovery Replay, my guy Chuck, he and his wife was talking after they listened to it, like, I never knew you felt that way. I had no idea. I didn't know. And so having that process in place, while difficult, it's necessary. And, you know, and I'll say this and land my plane. I can't tell you how many times I'll get like a phone call, text message, email of somebody listening to Recovery Replays. Like, you know what? I really thought my situation was exclusive to me. Mm-hmm. Right. And so when I went and listened to that, I went and talked to somebody. I went and got some help. I went and found an AA meeting or something. And so while those processes are difficult, clearly they can be impactful.
So I talked about the internal challenges of telling this story, but there were also external challenges. And I would say chief among them were, you know, number one, getting documents that I needed to support the research for the book. And then number two, just getting the right team and people in place who really understood the story, who got what I was trying to do, who were, you know, valuing the story and who were really going to be, you know, really rooting for this, you know, and helping me get it on the page. And so with respect to the documents, so I ended up having to try to get a lot of documents from the FBI, and I filed a Freedom of Information Act request. And as anyone who has done FOIA knows, it can be a very long and arduous process. And so it came to the point where I ended up having to file an administrative appeal of a decision that was adverse to me in terms of producing the documents on the time, you know, line that I had requested. And I did win that appeal, by the way. But that was one kind of battle that I had. I mean, a friendly battle, but a battle nonetheless. And then with respect to assembling the right people, you know, in trying to, you know, get this book published, of course, you know, I am trying to find an agent, you know, I'm trying to find a publisher. And so, as we all know, when you're trying, as a Black person, as a marginalized person, trying to get these stories out in the world can be very difficult simply because they are not valued, you know, as we talked about. And so, you know, I had people say things to me like, oh, you know, do you think this is a book? I mean, or is it really more like a magazine article? which I was like, I think it's a book. So, but I mean, ultimately, I did find that team, and I'm so deeply grateful that I have, you know, the right people. And this is why I firmly believe that, you know, we don't chase, we let things fall in place. So, and that's exactly what happened.
Thank you so much for that. You know, Lita, as you were talking, I was thinking about some of the more technical aspects, right? So you're talking about, so you might have this idea for a story, but then you also need other people along the way for a variety of different reasons. And so I'm wondering if you all could talk about maybe whether it's people or even equipment or just other maybe technical aspects that you've really used to help you tell your stories that might be useful to the folks in the audience who are also crafting their own narratives.
I feel like this is for you.
Okay. I can go. So for me, one of the biggest things that people love, especially in Black as America, is the sound design. So my job as, you know, the curator of these stories is to put you in that place that, you know, that the, you know, that the hero is experiencing, right? So I'll, you know, go to like a Elements Envato or, you know, Artlist.io, so that way I can put you in those moments. Because again, at the end of it, I want you to feel something. So we have to make sure that the music matches the tone of the story, all right? And sometimes it's... You know, the sound design, it takes a minute, right? Because you're literally going through hours upon hours upon hours to make sure you get the right tone. But once you find it, it makes sense. And so I'll say this. I remember in the Tom Lee episode where the boat capsizes, and I found, like, this perfect barge sound as, like, literally going underwater, right? You know, and then, like, this, you know, and I know this is morbid, but, you know, again, I'm trying to put you there, but, like, these screams, like, these gurgling screams as the boat capsizes. And while, again, I'm not trying to glorify what's happening, I'm really trying to put you in that moment. I'm trying to activate the theater of the mind, right? You know, it's just like the Kneeling Man in your book. The first couple of minutes, you use very descriptive words, right? And so I'm doing that as well, along with the sound design, to really activate that theater in the mind and put you in the place of that experience. So that way, you know, I really love taking my audience on peaks and valleys, right? You know, so I want to bring you down low, so that way we can bring you back up and have that this momentous occasion. So that sound design piece in podcasting is extremely important to my work.
Envato Elements is definitely our friend.
Listen,
it's our best
listen.
Friend. From a technical standpoint, Envato Elements, for anyone who's into film or sound or anything like that, is just the list where you can get fonts, graphics, sound effects. Literally, it's a playground. We love it. But yeah, I think people, you know, like Dominic was saying, it's very important to also have the tech side as well. Like, being creative is amazing, and you want to write and you want to do all these things, but you do have to take some time to really educate yourself on a lot of platforms and resources to use. I'm always encouraging my students to just explore, go on, you know, different websites, watch everything. Like, don't just watch things you're accustomed to. Watch foreign films, watch music videos, watch a lot of different things. And also for us, it's very important to know how to edit in different platforms. So don't just know how to edit on Premiere, you know, tap into Avid, tap into After Effects, tap into all these different things just so you can be a well-rounded person. And also, again, for me, I'm a very experimental editor, so I love to kind of step outside of the box and play with a lot of different things. And I think that is what makes every editor kind of unique, being able to just dabble in a lot of different pieces of content. But again, I would just say, you know, you really have to educate yourself somewhat on the business side of things and how to develop yourself creatively as well, like, you know, sound design and all those different things.
Yes, and for writing, which, you know, I mean, on one hand, it's sort of, you know, an old craft, but then again, at one time, the printing press was like this innovative and revolutionary technology, so it's all relative. However, I like what you said, Chastity, about learning the craft, and I think that is really critical when it comes to writing. And so, you know, I actually never really had any ambitions to become a writer until I felt that it was incumbent on me to tell this story. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at that point, you know, I was a lawyer. I was a litigator. And, you know, I think a lot of lawyers, we kind of think, okay, well, we can write because we write legal briefs. But this is something completely different. And you don't want a book-length brief kind of thing. But yet you want to get the story across and you want it to be factual and informative. And so I set about learning the craft of writing, which meant, step one was to take a creative nonfiction writing course. Mm-hmm. I took this course. I audited it, actually. Out of that course came the seed for The Kneeling Man, as well as some other pieces that had nothing to do with my dad's story that I also ended up polishing and getting published. And then also plugging into a community of writers was key. I firmly believe that everything that happens that matters happens in community. And so, you know, by attending workshops and conferences and just, you know, joining writing groups, just getting with a couple of people who are, you know, vibing, who are kind of trying to do the same sorts of things or even different sorts of things that are complementary was extremely helpful in getting this work done and just growing as a writer and as a human being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. You know, as I'm listening to each of you talk, you know, what occurs to me is I'm thinking that none of you really set out like when you were in kindergarten and said, hey, I'm going to write this memoir, right? Or I'm going to be a podcaster, or even I'm going to be a film editor. And so I'm wondering if you could talk about some of those maybe life experiences or even interests that you see yourself actually drawing from in your work. Lita, I mean, I'm thinking about you as a litigator, all of that experience researching and really getting to kind of the heart of the matter in presenting a case, right, that had to have come into play in writing the book. But I'm sure there are other maybe experiences or other little nuggets that you find yourself saying, oh, wait, I'm using this from, you know, decades ago, or this idea or interest or skill I'm now putting to work in this current area.
My grandmother's I wouldn't say she's a fashion designer, but she's a seamstress. She made a lot of my aunts and uncles and, you know, a lot of their, actually both of my grandparents were. So one thing about film editing is it started off being something where you actually had to sew the film together and kind of, you know, do all these different things. So I always was like really curious as to how she would like just take these fabrics and scraps and put all these things together, and I would help my grandmother sew and do all these different things, just learning how to use what you got and, you know, get things together. So stuff like that, I would say, is like, okay, maybe that's, you know, kind of where I got a lot of these inklings from. And even my sister being a dancer, a lot of my editing style and cinematography that I love to play with is movement. I love when things are moving across the screen. There's never a stagnant moment. There's never anything on sticks when I'm working on something. So I think stuff like that subconsciously you end up pulling from, just from like a creative standpoint. So I would say that would kind of be some things that I pulled from a little.
A few things, and I love this question because I often joke about it a little bit. But the first one is, well, I've always loved, like, the news, right? So nonfiction narrative just seemed like in the cards for me later on. But, you know, I was the kid that, you know, who was having a conflict to determine, was I going to watch Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, or Dan Rather each day, right? You know, because I really loved the news and, like, the human interest stories and stuff like that. I'm also the kid who stayed up late at night every 4 years watching the DNC or the RNC, just to like learn about, you know, what's going on in the world and stuff like that. So that's the first part. The second part is my teachers, particularly English teachers, because, you know, yeah, my wife is doing this because, and I'll get there in a second, but yeah, English teachers. I remember, you know, being in English class, like, I'm not going to use this stuff, man. Like, what, whatever. I'm like, no, whatever. And I remember two teachers in my senior year in high school, particularly my English teacher, you know, who I almost failed 12th grade English, like came super close, like razor thin, right? And my English teacher was telling me, like, you know, I was never going to let you fail, but just understand that, listen, you have potential in this space. You probably don't see it yet, you know, but, you know, but you have potential in this space. And then also, again, senior year, and took like a theater class, and my teacher was about, no, vocal warm-ups, rubber baby buggy bumpers and stuff like that, right? Like this is, I'm not going to use this stuff, man. Come on. And she's just like, humor me. So I'm sitting here one day, like years later, 30 years later, writing the script for, it might have been for Wendell Scott. I'm writing the script for Wendell Scott, the first African-American to participate in racing NASCAR. And I'm like, I'm writing this and the other, and like have my narrative arc going, and I get ready to record, like rubber baby, oh crap. She got me. So, you know, it, like, but education is just one of those things where it's like, you know, it was stored in there, but like that recall came when I needed it most. And, you know, and to this day, they're always like, see, I told you. And then I married an English teacher, so there it goes.
Absolutely. Education, you know. And when I entered college, I actually, you know, I was interested in the French language, and that's what I majored in. But then, you know, my mom said, well, shouldn't you have something else as well? Because let's think about after graduation. So I said, okay, well, I'll just tack on political science. That way I can go to law school and everything will be fine. I actually had wanted to go to the School of Journalism at my university. And my mom said, absolutely not. That's a terrible idea, because she was a journalist. So I listened to her. And, you know, I took all these French classes and I love them. And a lot of those classes were literature classes where I was reading novels in French, not just from France, but all over the Francophone world, you know, from parts of Africa and, you know, the Caribbean, elsewhere. And I really developed a love for literature, and, you know, we wrote papers about these things, but I never really thought about, until fairly recently, how formative that was for me, just in terms of, you know, engaging with literature and becoming a writer and just thinking about the craft of writing.
I love it. Everything comes back around. That's what I always say. Like, you just never know what you're going to draw from.
Like, I literally was just in the recording booth like, damn it, she was right.
Yeah, it happens all the time. You know, I'm wondering, because each of you are in very distinctive fields with kind of their own conventions or their own expectations. And I'm wondering how you leverage both what's expected of your respective industries in telling your stories, but also how you use those traditions or those expectations and kind of break them or challenge them in order to tell your particular stories.
I think for me, you have to kind of have a little bit of delusion. And I know that's weird to say, but I try not to, like, put this pressure on me of, like, you know, I am woman and I, you know, all these different things. Because working with the NBA, coming into that, they were like, now, how did she get this job? Who is she with? Who's, you know, who did she get to get? And I'm like, I mean, I grew up in South Florida where literally it was like, everybody's football, basketball, track. My cousin is Coco Golf. Like, everybody plays sports in my family but me. So it made sense for me to do that. But I think you have to have just like a somewhat of a sense of delusion where, yes, you kind of have like your culture and who you are kind of like in your back pocket, absolutely, and you use those intentions. But also, like, I don't tap into what society says I am or what I should be. Like I said earlier, kind of having like a journal entry with my creativity. So I just kind of like, if I know that I can do something, like, editing is a very technical job. It does not matter what race, color, creed you are. Like, Premiere doesn't care who you are. Editing is like, just make a good film, please, please. So I always go into it kind of a little like, I'm just going to be really good at this, and I'm going to study this particular subject and really invest myself in, like, you know, this French story or this, you know, whatever story it is, and just be that story, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I think one of my greatest attributes in this space is the fact that I didn't go to journalism school or I didn't go to broadcasting school. And so, and I'm not saying I'm knocking those things, but I think a lot of my creativity would have been maybe stamped out a little bit if I went through the normal process, if you will, right? Because I've been so focused on, okay, it's not at the right dB, or like the sound, you know, it's too loud or whatever, right? And you still need those things. Let me be very clear. But I think a lot of times we get so focused on it has to be so standard in a way that we that the creativity gets you know kind of stamped out and mapped out or whatever. So, but no, I you know, in addition to that, I also watch different type of films and other mediums to try to get inspired by that. But yeah, but that's probably my answer, I guess.
When you're dealing with a topic that has the gravity of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., with that comes a huge responsibility, and I've always felt the weight of that responsibility. And you know, at the same time, I thought it was important to reframe the official, you know, story, so to speak, or you know, to look at it through a different lens. You know, not from a prominent civil rights figure or movement, not from a conspiracy theorist or you know, skeptic of the official record, but actually from the perspective of someone who was there on the balcony in this famous photograph, but who most people don't even notice, and the unique vantage point that this man had. And I just think that it's so important to add those different dimensions and layers to a story like this, because you need that richness to really have a more complete understanding of what happened and what it means.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, there's so many stories or ideas that we have that we take for granted, that we think this is the entire narrative. But as each of you show, that's not the case, right? There are so many different aspects or perspectives that we need to hear in order to get a fuller picture. Lita, you brought up an interesting point, which is thinking about, for example, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., something that is very culturally resonant, significant in our nation's history, and then especially for each of us who have ties to Memphis, right? Very central to kind of our identity as Memphians. I'm wondering, how do you balance, you know, the cultural significance of some of the stories you're telling, but also the need, as you mentioned, to bring in these different perspectives or to tell a different piece of the story? So what does that balance look like, and how do you manage that?
Well, I think that you know, really, I have a mantra that I did not create this, but I heard it and it just stuck with me, which was, you know, when you're telling a story, keep it simple and tell the truth. Mm. It's really two things. Keep it simple, tell the truth. I think the balance comes out of the story. If you're following these guidelines, then I think that, you know, I think the balance will be there. The story actually has a life of its own. It really becomes a living entity. The story will show you and guide you what needs to be there, what does not need to be there, what does the reader need to know, you know, and narratively, you know, how do you strike that balance? For example, you know, at the beginning I talked about weaving in my own narrative with my father's narrative. And it was really kind of a technically difficult thing to do, because I thought, okay, well, I have a certain number of chapters. Does there need to be some kind of metric, like, okay, dad, me, you know, percentages or something? But what I realized was, no, it doesn't need to be that at all. And the story will show you where your story, you know, will pick up from your father's. And so I think really it's just following the flow of the narrative. Keep it simple, tell the truth.
There's a few things I do with podcasting, because podcasting is kind of the new shiny toy in the medium space now, right? But one of the things I do is try to tell stories from different perspectives, kind of like to your point a little bit, right? So when we released the episode of Ann Lowe, I could have just told about Ann Lowe was born in 1898, and she did this, and she learned fashion design from her mom, and this, that, and the other. Or I can tell you the story, start the story with how We're at this wedding in 1953 in Rhode Island, and John F. Kennedy is about to marry Jacqueline Lee Bouvier, you know, come to know Jackie Kennedy, and how this beautiful dress that everybody is fawning over and everybody loves it, right? And then I can tell you that, you know, you could have thought it was Christian Dior or Christian Ball Balenciaga, or no, it was this African-American woman named Ann Lowe who told this story. So it's just one of those things, it's the angles for me, like how the Instagram, you know, pictures and stuff like that, the kids, you know, it's the angles for me, right? And so you try to like present it in a different way, because one of the things I know about history and stuff like that, well, first off, people who listen to podcasts love to be tricked into learning. So that's one. They love to be tricked into learning something. And then two, it's one of those things where I'm trying to just present this really cool narrative that people can gravitate towards. And one of the things I love to do is to deploy the 2-3 minute rule. So every 2 to 3 minutes within a podcast episode, something changes. There's a fading of music. There's a fade out of music. There's a whole different story you didn't even see coming, right? For instance, we told the story of Dory Miller, who was fighting on during Pearl Harbor and stuff like that. Like, yeah, Dory Miller did this cool thing, this and the other, but it ain't nothing like Charles Jackson French. And I'm going to go ahead and stop the music right now because you didn't even know who that was, did you, right? So I'm like switching up the narrative right there in that moment. So it's like I'm trying to stand out in the podcasting world, but also at the same time just to kind of keep the listener on edge to try to make sure that I'm engaged with them. So,
yeah, so cool. I definitely understand that because I try to – like, there's always a conversation in Hollywood, like, oh, this doesn't sell, or, you know, foreign doesn't sell, women don't sell, you know, all this. And I'm just like, what makes us the same is what makes us different to a certain degree. Like, the amount of spaghetti that I grew up eating was absolutely ridiculous, but I'm not Italian, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was cheap, and it was easy, and it was something my mom can make. So I think I just try to look at storytelling and perspectives as, like, just because this is a story about one specific person doesn't mean this other type of people aren't going to be interested in it. Because to a certain degree, yeah, there's only 5 stories, but this person experienced it this way, and this person experienced it that way, and this is how it's in Asia, and this is how it is in America, you know? So that's, like, really important, you know? So I kind of try to look at everything almost like in food, you yes. know, to a certain degree, where it's like, you know, who doesn't love a taco? And if you don't, then we need to have a conversation. But you can make a taco anything, you know? You can make it Caribbean and jerk. You can make it Italian. You can make it, you know, a lot of different things. So I just, you know, try to look at everything as, like, we are different, but we are the same. We still have the same blood, the same interests, you know, the same, you know, just things that we want to do.
Yeah, just hopes and dreams and stuff like that. Exactly. Because, like, I know one of my biggest influences are Hindi films. I love a good Hindi film, right? From the dancing to the, you know, now you gotta sit through a Hindi film because they can be pretty long, right?
Stay long.
But listen, once you get to the good part, it's well worth the wait. And that's another thing that we try to deploy, right? It's one of those things where you're trying to have this slow build. And, like, maybe it's a journey, but I promise you when you stick with it, you're going to love it at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we'd love to hear some questions from you all. If there's anything that you would like to ask these panelists, I mean, we have film, we have podcasting, we have essay and literature. So if you have any questions, there's a microphone right here. We'd love to chat with you all. But if you don't have any questions and are putting all on me like my students do and making me do all the work this morning, we can do that too. But if there is a burning question that you want to ask, we would love to be able to answer your question this morning. Yes, if you want to come to the microphone so we can all hear you, that would be great.
Hey, I think you actually touched on it a little bit on that last question, but with, you know, there's now a massive amount of content, and it seems like people's attention spans are shrinking every day. So I guess when you're making whatever you're making, how do you think about that? Do you think about that, or do you just let the content speak for itself and see what happens?
That's a really good question. I always have, like, mixed feelings about it because I do find myself being like, all right, we can't do a 3-hour movie. We can't, you know, do certain things like that. But at the same time, if a story is good, people are going to digest it. So there's still a lot of films that are 2 hours long, 3 hours long. And one cool thing about media, like what we do when we're doing a commercial for the Super Bowl, so to speak, we'll have like a 90, you know, second or whatever, but then we'll do cut downs. So we'll have this version for TikTok, this version for Instagram, this completely different version for broadcast. So it's kind of a mix, but I will say if the story, like Everything Everywhere All at Once, this is a long movie. It's beautiful. It's a long movie. But, and we were like, oh, it's, people aren't gonna, you know, but it went like wildfire. So I think if the story is good and the content is there, it could still kind of work depending on what it is.
I agree completely. And I think, you know, the story, you know, is the most important thing. And if it's if the story is the right size for the story that it is, you know, if it's tailored, if the length of it is tailored to the story, and it's a great story, then people will always engage. I mean, I think about books like the Harry Potter books. They're huge, and people just, you know, rip through those and fly through them because they're engaged, they're pulled in. I mean, I can think of any number of books like that, you know, podcasts. I mean, there were some popular podcasts that came out this year. Everybody would know them if I said them. I mean, they're pushing 3 hours, and I didn't have time to listen to those podcasts, but I made time to listen to those podcasts because that's how engaging they are. And so, yeah, I really just focus on right-sizing my, you know, narrative for the actual content, for the story.
A few things that I consider, it's kind of back in mind, but then again, it's not, right? So it kind of goes back to that 2-3 minute rule that I was talking about earlier, right, where I'm switching it up ever so often. But within those 2 to 3 minutes, I know those that 2-3 minutes itself can be its own segment. So I can put that as a short form content piece by itself while still maintaining the long form narrative arc. Because I think a lot of times, you know, just like you both were saying, people say, you know, attention span, short form content is the thing or whatever, right? And then along comes Risa Tisa and totally completely blows that out of the water, right? You know, it was like 50 part series. We all was glued to that, right? And so again, I think if a story is good, a story is good, and people are gonna latch on to it. So, but I would, like I said, to anybody who's podcasting, whatever, think about your episodes and think about how you can break those into small pieces for like social media or something like that. So
this is a question for all of you, but it was, I think, jostled loose by something, Lita, that you said, which was that it's so important to speak truth and to speak that truth simply. And I wonder, do you have your own sort of thoughts and perspectives or approaches that allow you to distill to something essential?
I do, actually, because when I think about truth, which in and of itself, you know, as you say, what is truth? I mean, that's a famous quote from a famous book. However, when I look at truth, I look at it as a matter fundamentally of perspective, of lens. You know, the truth of this room is one thing to me because I'm sitting here looking this way. The truth of this room is very different to someone who's sitting in the back corner. And so when I am, you know, telling a story, you know, a fact-based story, I'm always cognizant of the lens, the perspective, the position. I think that has to be acknowledged that, you know, I am not the arbiter of all truth. I am not omniscient. And, you know, I think that, you know, to your point, yes, that a story to me is sort of like a gemstone that you're polishing and you're faceting. It is multifaceted. Each of those facets is a simple thing. It's just a question of putting the facets in, you know, and shining a light on them. So, and then in that one multifaceted thing, you have a story.
There's another saying to that point, you know, two things can be true, right? And so I think for that question, it all goes back to my North Star. What story am I trying to tell? And so that's the truth I'm going to present. That doesn't mean that if anything else comes up, that means it's untrue. It's just one of the things, that's not the story that I'm telling, to your perspective point, if you will. We had an episode about Marian Anderson and how she was not able to sing at Constitution Hall back in the day and stuff like that. And then there was this campaign for her to sing at the Lincoln Memorial. And in my research, I saw that it was the NAACP who led this approach. And then I saw a documentary that said, no, it was Eleanor Roosevelt who led this approach. And so I think it's one of those things where it's like, I think both of those things probably happened, right? Who led who is, what, it's splitting hairs here. But I think it goes back to whatever that North Star is, what am I trying to convey at the end of that story? If Marian Anderson is the hero, then I'm going to lean towards whatever truth I need to convey that point, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I would just say, you know, they said everything, but laying it all out, you know, a lot of things are true. I watched a documentary last night where, you know, Freaknik was just a picnic of college kids kind of getting together, but then it started to get really wild. But at the same time, it's like, yes, this was this great event, but yes, a lot of bad things happened. And yes, it affected the community. And yes, it also empowered us. And yet, you know, it was, there were so many different truths, but it was just like, this is just what it is. Like, this person is a great person, or this thing is a great thing, but that great thing may have affected a lot of other things that didn't, weren't so great. So I think just laying it all out and kind of, you know, just looking at it where it was like, well, this is just what happened, is like really key.
I just want to say this point really quickly. You made me think about it just now. I think we live in a society, I'm kind of going on my soapbox here just a little bit. We live in a society where it feels like, oh, if this is my truth, then yours can't be true, right? Like, and I think, you know, that's a very dangerous place to be. And I think all of us as storytellers have to be mindful of that. Like, even though this is what I found to be true, it's okay to welcome other people to that conversation, because they're going to provide a different perspective. They're going to provide a different type of truth, if you will. And I think that makes the story even more wholesome.
So it looks like we only have time for one more question, unfortunately. So please.
Hello. So, you know, creativity and storytelling is kind of a weird space, because you guys all touched on education, whether you go the traditional route or you make it your own. And I think, you know, regardless of what route you go in, what you learn from others is not what's going to make you good. It's the thing that you do and make it uniquely you. And so this kind of leads to my question, and it's a little bit more emotional. It's about imposter syndrome. Is there a hump that, like, you finish? I want to know, personally, because I'd love to get over that. Or is that something that you face with every day and you struggle with, you have to contend with? And is it something that you have to fix internally? Is it something that you work with others and, like, you need to hear? I think it might be different for everyone also. But I just wanted to know, you know, from seasoned creatives, how you guys handle that.
Yeah, that's a very real question. When I first got into the industry, I had huge imposter syndrome, where I was just like, I'm finna put my head down and edit. I'm not finna talk to nobody. We're not a family. This is work. Like, let's not do the whole corporate thing. No small talk. I'm not going to lunch with y'all. Like, it was hard, because I was, you know, this was, well, now it's like 15 years ago, around 2010, 2011. So there was literally no one who looks like me. And also, I just was just uncomfortable in the space as a creative. Like, I thought I was getting into this, like, super fun, you know, like, yeah, we're going to hang out and go to the beach. And it was like, nah, you got to work for 12 hours and, you know, on top of people that I couldn't relate to. But I think after a while, like, once you hit a certain mark or a certain beat in your career, you start to feel all the feelings of your industry. And I think you internally just, like, a fire just comes out of nowhere where you just want to start speaking. Almost like being a baby. Like, you're a baby and you're free-spirited, but for whatever reason, when you turn 11, you just start feeling yourself. So I think that kind of happens naturally for people. Like, you literally have to grow up creatively and grow up in who you are as a professional, because when you're just starting out, you're not necessarily, you know, an expert or OG or, you know, all these different things. You have to kind of take the time to, like, experience it. And then when that experience kind of hits you and you start, you know, finding your voice, then it slowly starts to introduce you to a lot of different things. And then you start finding people who also are kind of like hiding too, and you become, you know, friends. And, you know, it's something that does happen naturally, but, you know, you're not alone in that situation. It happens for all of us, because it took me, I don't think I became this loud as an editor probably until about 4 or 5 years ago. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, 100% yes, applause, because yes. And again, this is back to the point of community that you alluded to. Being in community is a huge way to, you know, grow up creatively and get past that imposter syndrome, because what you will find is that everybody feels like this. And yet, you're accomplishing things, and once you start to accomplish things, your confidence will naturally build because you're building a track record.
It's a beast that shows up every day. I'm just going to be honest. It shows up every single day. Season one of Black is America, I'm making the episode for Guy on Blueford about the first black astronaut, and I'm listening to, like, man, this is garbage. This isn't good. Whatever. But I have to remind myself that, like, I'm also, when I'm, you know, writing and editing and stuff like that, I'm hearing all those single pieces singularly. They haven't come together yet. So sometimes it's just trusting the process, right? You know, and that, like, it's like you've done this before, you got evidence, it's gonna work out. Just trust the process, keep moving forward. And again, I will highlight community. Right when you're down on in the dumps and you're like, man, I don't know, and then you have those cheerleaders, oh, come on, man, you're the blah 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 the blah blah blah, and you know, and then you have the people, oh, you mean the same person who did XYZ, that's the person that's having imposter syndrome today, oh, okay, sure, woe is me. But I say all that to say that, like, the community is so important to make sure that not only to keep you, you know, hyped up and that you're going in the right place, but also keep you grounded. Because me and my therapist talk about my ego often, right? So it's one of those things where the community is essential.
And I'll just wrap up this panel saying, I think about, is it the work you're doing, is it purpose or is it pride? Because then the source of those feelings might be pointing you in a different direction. But if the work you're doing is about purpose, then sometimes that insecurity we feel, we're supposed to feel that way. Because if we're too confident in the work we're doing, then sometimes I think, is this actually simply ego? And so that's also something that I think about. Well, we are actually over time, but let's thank our panelists, Chastity J, Dominic Lawson, and Lita McCullough-Seletsky. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for tuning in to Let's Grab Coffee. This is WYXR 91.7 FM. And don't forget to subscribe to Let's Grab Coffee in podcast format and on YouTube so you never miss a conversation. And then you can also re-listen, because there's always so many good gems that I know you have to go back to. I know that I do. I re-listen to these shows all the time. Thanks so much again for joining me. And I can't wait for us to spend some more time together next week.